There are no words in the encyclopedia, in the thesaurus, and in the dictionary to describe how I have felt during the time of the childhood victimization. I cannot put into any language the states of my mind in terms of emotion and thought patterns. In relation to the confronting of that same childhood victimization. I gotta start talking about my sexuality. I was gang raped I was so raped I remember the pornography that was shown to me as a at that age. I remember the domestic violence. I remember seeing so-called ADULTSs in quotations having sex in my presence. I had to pause for a moment. I remember seeing I remember being whooped by the demons myself. And I will tell you how I recovered and still am in forever recovery regarding the you-know-whats. I've had a psychological support team for years, as I've told y'all about. And there's this new thing I didn't tell you about. I had a conversation with my grandma Clara about these things. I didn't tell y'all this part. All the other ways, you know, I've recovered, you know, but I have to mention this because I'm not ashamed of this part of my life. There's no part of my life that I'm ashamed of because I've healed that well. I was placed in a psychiatric hospital for a weekend because I had something of the excessive buildup of anxiousness, and it caused me to lash out at my male parent. And I remember the police, they were able to intervene because somebody called the police. And I remember being in the squad car. Folks outside of it were making fun of me, pointing at me, giggling and laughing, because I was the young black male in the back of a police car. And I tried my best to not even be inside of that motherfucker, meaning the vehicle. My family had to talk to me for years, and my other cousins, about don't ever place yourself in situations where you can be in a any police hassle. But I'm protected beyond measure and endangered beyond compare. So I was in a psychiatric hospital. I remember I barely talked with the officer. The officer's calming me down because in the squad car, I was crying and engaging in negative self-talk. I mean, it's understandable. I'm in a squad car. I remember driving into the hospital with the officer, and the officer was filling out my name to be a part of the hospital. That was the same hospital that 17 years ago my grandma Clara was pronounced transitioned in the flesh no more. So that was an eerie way that I was remembering her unconsciously. More importantly, it was a gorgeous way to do it. And I was on the phone with my best friend at the time, who's like a sister to me. She knows this story. She's okay with me sharing this story. She and I were talking, and I had to move a spot because I thought I was disrupting the people in the hospital, because they were looking at me when I was talking. And I put the phone down, telling my best friend, I'm putting the phone down now. I think I need to clear up some things really quickly with the decent people to my right. So after the sign-in was over, I got to talk to my best friend, right? It was going to take me a while to sign up. They were all doing a lot of paperwork to get me in the hospital. There were elderly people to my right, and I said, I am very sorry for being loud. I'm not supposed to be loud. I will try my best to keep my voice down. They looked at me, smiled with a puzzle, and said, We didn't think you were being loud. We enjoyed the conversation that you had with your best friend. And your conversation really helped us out, because what happened to you when you were younger should have never happened to you. And they were like, no, we want you to keep talking to your best friend. Keep talking to her. We want to keep listening. So I talked until I got this feeling of maybe I'm lacking victory. So I had to move, because I recognized I was sitting in the same spot I sat in as a 7-year-old when I found out my grandma was pronounced transitioned. She, along with my Brewer family, were crying up a storm at that time. And I made a vow to never sit in that spot again 17 years ago, but because I was feeling so out of it, maybe that's a harsh way to put it. I'll say it this way, maybe I was so into the shock of what happened earlier with the lashing out of my dad, and you know, it was beside traffic and people were coming over to me in the Taurus and I was crying in front of everybody. They wanted to know what happened, and I told them my childhood abuse. I was telling strangers the trauma. People on bikes were coming to me to make sure I was okay. I never thought I would lay a hand on any of my parents, but that happened. And then like a couple of weeks later, my dad and I were able to make it up on. We basically got out in the car where the unfortunate incident took place, quickly prayed for forgiveness, got back in the car and drove off. When I was in the ward, because I want to spend more time talking about how I recovered, so I'll say this. When I was in the ward, I was always protected. I was too embarrassed to call any of my other friends at the time. This happened after I got a haircut. So I came in there with a fresh haircut. And one of the Bibles my dad had was lost. So I was able to buy him another Bible weeks later when we was at church. I was able to, you know, pay, what, $25-some off my debit card. I had plenty of money. I still had plenty of job money that I paid for personally for my dad. So when I was in the ward, I was surrounded by people with those who were struggling with addiction to hardcore drugs, and you know how a nurse is struggling with the attitudes of the clients in the ward. And I was well protected in the ward by people who would, by experts, would have each and every kind of mental illness that you can think of, each and every kind of personality disorder you could think of was in it. So I was protected all the time. We would swap lunches all the time, and the women at the psych ward, the nurses and the staff were always checking up on me, making sure I was okay, complimenting me out loud to other women staffers and the women people who are, what's the best way to put it? Patients were complimenting me. And I remember the women staffers and the women patients were consistently giving me the eye. So I said, I must be still a gentleman because they think highly of yours truly, to lighten up the mood. Of course, everything in a ward that you could think of does happen, but I was never violated in any kind of way. I was able to be there for a whole weekend and not be violated. I mean, I was in the ward and it was quiet most of the time, watching TV and dryers right there. I didn't even take a shower until the day I got out and my parents came, got me and left. I walked out with one of my roommates, because in the psych ward you have roommates, and in the psych ward we're asking each other, so what you in for, right? It's like it's a jail type question we told each other. When it got to my turn, at first they're celebrating like, yo, Antonio went off and his pops, and I had to tell them that's not worthy of celebration, and they figured out, oh, okay, right. I'm summarizing this perfectly. So I remember being in the ward and witnessing every kind of issue that mental illness brings. I'll just leave it at that. But there was no torture at all at the ward. I just want you to know. There was a lot of me being shy and quiet more than ever, and everybody was always worried that maybe he's not eating enough, maybe he should eat more, and so they're constantly giving me more and more food than everybody else because I was very quiet, and the patients and staffers were constantly coming up to me like, we have to get you to talk because, you know, You're so silent in a way that it makes us wonder, are you okay? Because whenever somebody tried to approach me, I would be hesitant to talk because I thought they're trying to do me in. So at first when they would come up to me, I'm kind of looking at them, my eyes on the floor, kind of out my socket. They're like, oh no, I just want to get to know you, how you doing? I said, good. But I had a business way of approaching it, like, okay, I had a strictly business way, but it wasn't unfriendly. It was more of, I made sure that I was all the way level-headed every time I was asked a question, every time I made a comment. I was always aware of what could happen if I lost my temper, what could happen if I went off, what could happen if my nerves were negatively touched. So when I asked a question or answered a question, when I made a statement or other people make statements, most of the time I was emotionless because in a ward, I was so afraid if I show emotion, they may take me out the ward and put me in another one, or what if they go, okay, we're going to put you in jail. So I was fear of jail the whole time. So, yeah, we also had this you know, there was hygiene issues and cleanliness issues. We have so many people in the ward. Hey, so I was able to be in that ward for the whole weekend. I didn't go to church that weekend, and I felt like I was going to hell because I didn't go to church that weekend. And I thought about how being in that ward, we had this activities where we had depression seminars. They taught us about depression, and you had a higher chance of getting out the ward if you reported a high sense of happiness, you know, 7 to 8, all the way up to 10. So I would usually feel like an 8, so I would say 8. And that's how I was able to get out there faster. And some of the people would say 4 or 5, and that meant you're going to stay longer at the ward because this is what I remember. And they were like, in order to get out, they need to know that your sense of joy is strong. I remember mine was extremely high because I was talking to my grandma the whole time. So I pretty much summed up the ward experience, right? They wheelchaired me to the ward and fed me before I got in. Didn't have enough hospital beds, they put me in the ward. All the psychiatrists say no medicine nor medications for him. And he looked, and one of the psychiatrist guys, black man, looked at me and said, I don't mean to put race in it, but I remember he was black man. The rest were white women, I think. Yes, they were white women, I know for certain. And I remember them saying, because of your happy, happy, joy, joy, trauma response, because of your natural happy joy person, that saved you from needing medication and pills, because for years all that laughter and smiling kept you so mentally strong that we're here to tell you no medication of any kind for you. And I was amazed because I felt like I had a nervous breakdown, so I was in the hospital bed, on and off, talking to my best friend at the time. So I was even more amazed that all the psychiatrists said no medication for him. He just needs continued therapy, and he'll be fine. So at one last therapy session, once I got out, and my therapist at the time said, you don't need therapy anymore. You're good to go. And how did I handle not having therapy for so long? Me talking to my grandma, my mom, Clara. She was with me in the ward. You know that scene? And you know the scenes in the Ray movie about Ray Charles, 2004, Jamie Foxx? Every time something pivotal happened in Ray's life, his mom would appear. My grandma, Clara, is the same way with me. Every time I have major circumstances, she's right there beside me, literally, not just figuratively. Here are exact words to me when I was in the ward. And before I say, I was able to encourage my roommate with giving him wisdom about how life would be better for him because he was a homeless person. I'm not using his name, so he's not bothered by it because I'm not using his name. But I gave him all the encouragement that is appropriate for a person in the ward. And as I was leaving, he walked out with me. And there were people at the ward highly upset that me, the big brother, me, the life coach to them, me, the encourager of them, having a life outside the ward that is positive. They were upset, but they were the main ones vouching for me to get out of the ward. Isn't that something? And they made sure on Monday I was out, and on Monday I was out because they kept badgering and bugging the staffers. Get him out, get him out, get him out. When is Antonio gonna come out? When is Antonio gonna come out? We don't have him out. There's gonna be a problem. Get him out, get him out, get him out, right? So they got me out. And some people go, why are you telling the story publicly? My self-esteem is so healthy that I don't give a fuck who clowns me for it. I don't give a fuck who's a hater of mine. I don't give a fuck who's a detractor of mine. I don't give a fuck who's a naysayer of mine. I don't give a fuck would talk shit about me for it, because, you know, the only people I give a fuck about, the ones who say, I fucking love you, I fucking appreciate you, and I fucking respect you for doing your damnest to be my safe haven, to be my safe space, and to be my safe grace. Those are the only people that motherfucking matter to me. So, my conversation with my grandma. She said to me, son, I said, mom, mommy, right? And she hugged me. And she said, son, I was sent here on earth to have you talk to me about some very very sensitized matters. And I said, Mom, I think you want to know about my childhood. She says, that's exactly why I'm here. To know about something that wasn't, that I didn't get to, that I need to hear from you. So I told her everything that happened to me when I was a child. She hugged me. And I remember her saying, son, there's nothing about you that offends me. The struggles with religion, faith, spirituality, I'm not offended. Non-traditionalism, I'm not offended. The all of what you've been through, I'm not offended by you at all. She said, He said, "Son, I'm gonna be in this ward with you as long as it takes." I remember having out loud conversations with her and my roommate I told you about watched, and he didn't think I was crazy. And he didn't think that something was off with me because of my sweet nature disposition. It may sound like oxymoron. I'll just say my sweet disposition. I don't want to sound redundant, I meant to say. My grandma also said these words to me. She said, "Son, once we walk out of this war together, I'm going to make it up to you. I'm going to spend more time on earth with you. I'm going to protect you a whole lot more. I'm going to make sure that life blesses you a whole lot better. And I need to have more talks with you. And a lot of the talks, most of them are going to hurt. Because I need to hear from you more of your thoughts and feelings. The fact that my son, when you were on earth, there are times I saw you look sad. And I had an inkling, but I assumed that maybe it was school related. I didn't know when you got to where you were that particular place wasn't home for you. So I told her everything that happened to me about the abuse. I had honest talks with her about my religious skepticism, my non-traditional views on anything and everything, and just all things me that you all know about from, if you listen to previous podcast episodes, go figure. And I told her my free thinking, free living, free loving, free spirited nature that is in by all directions, in all respects, in all aspects, by all available means. Heard her words, she said, "There's no such thing as disagreement within our relationship," she said. "We came from diverse eras, diverse generations. So, yes, I lived my life as a traditional Christian, Bible-believing woman, but I got to be more educated from you about how life was for you as a child." And then I told her the struggles of being a black millennial during this time, as well as the autism labels I was given. And she said, "When you die, you'll take your first breath in paradise with me, because I'll be the very first being that you see. And I will make sure that you are teleported to heaven myself. Everybody else up there is going to be right beside us, but I'm leading the way because I told them. This is my child. There's nobody better at taking them to heaven than me. I'll do it." I just remember that talk I had with her. She said, God has so much grace and mercy for you. I said, grandmother time. I said, mom. I had to say mom all the time because grandma's too formal. I said, grandma. I mean, mom. Mom. When I was growing up, there are times where I was made to feel like there were birthing problems or birth defect problems or me feeling like I'm the most sin-natured human being in the world. And is that how God tells me? He said, no. And there's nothing wrong with you. There's nothing mistake. There's nothing that says mistake about you. And there's nothing that says error about you. Error about you. She said none. She told me, these things. She said to me, I know when you were at church, you had a hard time praising the Lord because of the trauma triggers and flashbacks that happened at church and outside of church, you know, the childhood plagues, I call them that. And I had trouble praying on my knees every day, like she said, and watching Christian television, everything, like she said. The praying on my knees every day thing was difficult because of the trauma. And and Christian television having Trump people on there, she said, it's fine if you don't want to watch that every day. It's cool. And she said, oh, listen to Christian music every day. And I said, some of the messages they have really trigger me, Mom. She said, it's okay. Any secular song that makes you, reminds you of Christ's likeness, just listen to that. Because post-traumatic stress would even act up in church. The post-traumatic stress I never asked for. So the perfectionism is over when it comes to my grandma, and perfectionism is over in general. So another type of conversation my grandma had, we both said that it's, you know, I learned that when you write letters to those who have transitioned, it aids in the healing process. So that's my biggest form of therapy, is I write literary conversations between myself and my grandma. And she's helped me to not see my unemployment as unemployment. She says, it's time for people to take care of you. You've taken care of so many people. It's time for people to take care of you. It's time for people to listen to you and be sensitive to you and make sure you're paid and make sure you got a place to stay. Make sure your career stays flourishing and make sure your gifts keep being nourishing. And she's right. She is absolutely fucking lutely right. And let's talk about my recovery now, right? My grandma and I, you know, after we were in the ward and we cried together, hugged her, ran up on her. Here's how I've been recovering. You know, I take more naps. I'm podcasting. I'm writing. I make more time for happy than sad. I don't watch the news anymore. I only use technology for podcasting, podcast collaborating, writing, and that's it. If I choose to listen to music on YouTube, it's positive music. There are times when I think of Jesus, I want to ask this question. Is Jesus' death on the cross divine homicide? I just want to put that doubt out there. I don't live a life of people give me word salad anymore. Religion doesn't make my life happier or better or give me more joyful emotions. Moral excellence, in my view, has no faith. Moral correctness has no religion. And moral success has no spirituality. I dare say that. By deep reflecting, by meditating, by having my quiet moments, and being okay with the fact that I'm not like everybody else, and being okay with being in the forefront as a global justice warrior, that's also how I recover. I recover by going public with my real thoughts. I recover by allowing myself the rights of knowing my rights. I know all my rights. I look at rape as a hate crime. You hate somebody while you're doing the crime. All abuse should be considered hate crimes because you hate them while you're doing the crimes. So all of my sexual rights and human rights were violated when I was a child. By educating myself on my rights and, you know, caring about other people's human rights have caused me recovery too. And here are other ways that I've recovered. I decide, because I'm going to have my own place very, very soon. I'm in the process of getting my own spot. I made a decision to only have positive people come in and out of my home every week and every month until I meet my mom, Clara, once again. Because I got that proper household boundaries in check. And my grandma has this quote. I think I'm going to start doing episodes of her quote. So this is quote number one. This quote, see, my recovery's in stages, so I won't do parts. I'll just talk about her quotes. So if you want to know how I recovered, she says, "What's out there is out there. Don't bring out there in here," referring to her telling her kids to keep the world's mess out of her home. She basically said to me, this is her exact words, "I don't want any negative motherfuckers in your house. And I'm glad that you don't want any negative motherfuckers in your house." She says, "All the people in your house are positive ass people, and you're a positive ass person yourself." No, she said, "I don't want no bullshit in your house, and I'm glad you're not going to have bullshit in your house. Because you're anti-bullshit. I'm anti-bullshit. So a truly optimistic home is a home that is just anti-bullshit to the T." She said, "If people don't respect your rules, then those ass cracks don't deserve to be in your home." And she said, "Never bring shit in your castle because you're a king." And she said, "When I had a house, I never brought shit in my castle because I'm a queen." And that thinking really has done me a lot of good. To know that that is how she was able to help me through that quote. I got these quotes from my dad, but then my grandma in spirit was able to tell me how that quote will give me recovery. She said, "If you pay for something, don't let other people run it for you." She said, in layman people's terms, she said, "You got a house, right? Yeah. Don't let other people run your household for you. Your name is on it, so the mortgage means you, right? Right." She said, "It's okay to stand up to folks in your house, set healthy boundaries, and keep them firm with folks in your house, and everybody abide by household rules. If not," she said, "fuck them." She said, "Kick the piss bags out. You don't need those spit bags. You're better off with the shit bags. You're better off without the shit bags," she said. She said, "Those people are bags of throw up. You don't want to be bothered with them." She said, "Your house should be therapeutic. Your house should have guests with some sense." Most people in my family made a decision when I have my own home. Most people in my family won't be in it because some people that I love, after a while, their quirks become unbearable, and that's why I don't want to have them in my home, because that's not something I want to deal with for paid for property by me, you know what I'm saying? And so I recover in short bursts, and I tell you the recovery each time, but I'll use her quotes to help me recover. And my grandma said, whatever you control, try your best to have just you and other positive folks. She said that, and I have nothing else to say. I'll share more. This will be a quote series, but it won't be a part. It'll just be, I'll just say her quote, and that would be all. So, thank you for listening to me.